On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls. My name is Mary Yelkin. I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. I will serve as your moderator today. I will cover just a few things, have housekeeping at the beginning, and also let you know how you can actively participate today. This training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this first slide, Long-Term Contaminant Management Using Institutional Controls. It was a guidance document produced by ITRC in 2016. And although we will be able to share a lot of information with you today, we certainly won't be able to share all the details and all the tools and resources available in that guidance document. So we strongly encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't already done so, and we hope that it will become a resource that will serve you as you're working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and it's hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2.25 hours, and as I noted, we are recording this event so we can provide it as an archive for future listeners of this topic area. The trainers will be in control of the slides as we move through today's training session. If you would like to control your own slides, you are able to download a copy of the slides from the initial training page you were directed to today. And you can also access those slides over in the related links section by clicking on CLUIN training page and then click browse to. We want to hear from everybody on the training today, both your questions as well as your feedback. You'll have an opportunity about midway through for a question and answer break, as well as at the end. But at any time today, you're welcome to type in your questions in that Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. And then during the question and answer break, we'll get to answer as many of those verbally as we can. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we'll ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person in writing through the Adobe Connect website. For those of you on the phone line, if you would like to ask a question out loud, we'll also give you an opportunity to do that when we get to those Q&A breaks. And we'll remind you at that time that it is #6 to unmute. Also, there's an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went for you today. It's also your opportunity to get a certificate of participation if you would like to have that to help support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of that online feedback form, there's a box for you to click on to submit you participated today. Once you do that and press submit, that certificate will be provided to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and we are a network of state regulators working alongside our federal partners, being the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as our ITRC Industry Affiliates Program members, academia, and community stakeholders. All of these groups come together to work in technical teams to develop tools and resources and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today, to help people make better decisions when they're using innovative ideas, technologies, and methodologies. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC and learn how you can be a member, please check out the ITRC website. As we typically operate most of our teams on calendar year, you can register for teams or at least learn more about how you could become an active member in ITRC. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we do ask that you review that usage policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material or endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our experts for today, and they're serving as our trainers. All of them have been active members of ITRC's institutional control team over the years, and not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have put many, many hours of work to come to consensus to develop the associated guidance document. So a special thanks for them, or to all of them, for participating with us today. First, we'll hear from Kevin Schrems with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, Doug Burge with Ramboll, Doug Suter with GHD, Michael Sawinski with Teradex, Lynn Bailey with the Hawaii Department of Health, and Carol Murphy with Trihydro Corporation. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios from the link at the bottom of your screen. You can also access it over that related link section by clicking on CLUIN training page, and then click Browse to, At the bottom of that training page, you can access their bios and pictures as well. So with that, let's go on over to slide number 6, and I'll turn it over to Kevin Schrems with Michigan DEQ. Kevin?
Thank you, Mary, and thank you to all the attendees who are participating today. If this is your first time listening to the Institutional Control Long-Term Contaminant Management training, we are very excited for the opportunity to introduce to you the guidance document that is available. Before the trainers dive into the specifics of our materials, I want to take some time for institutional control foundation setting and talk about how our guidance document was developed and how it will be beneficial to you and the work that you do. For many of you on the call, the concept of leaving contamination in place was previously not an acceptable way of achieving closure under most regulatory programs. Most programs required contamination to be cleaned up to background or native concentrations. Now, since the mid-1990s, risk-based corrective action and the use of institutional controls has become an important part of many federal, state, and local cleanup and brownfield programs. Institutional controls are generally administrative or legal controls that help to minimize the potential for exposure now and into the future to contamination and protect the integrity of the remedy. ICs have helped fuel redevelopment and reduce cost and time to achieve closure at many sites. As an aside, Michigan has had over the years the tagline of R for R, or remediation for redevelopment, emphasizing considering sites for remediation work based on the potential for redevelopment of the site and the environmental and public health risks. For more background discussion of ICs, you can read ITRC's 2008 document noted on the screen. Now, the terminology and process descriptions used in our guidance document are consistent with those in the Federal Superfund program. The picture on the right half of the screen also visually illustrates the differences between engineering controls, which include vapor barriers, physical or hydraulic containment, asphalt or concrete barriers, and vapor mitigation systems, as well as institutional controls. These are the paper descriptions of legal restrictions. They function as they protect the integrity of that engineering control or minimize the potential for human exposure to contamination through the restrictions of activity. Both are incorporated under the umbrella of land use controls in our guidance document. And land use controls are used to provide protection from exposure to contaminants that exist or remain on site. Now, upon initiating the process of developing our guidance, ITRC understood that state agencies use ICs at contaminated sites as remedies. However, we did not know the full extent of their use. So ITRC also did not understand various state agency selection and implementation processes or the regulatory framework governing the ICs. Finally, ITRC wanted to gather information and determine how states manage and fund the ICs once they're in place, along with any data indicating that state agencies performed monitoring, tracking, enforcement, and stakeholder outreach. So to better understand these questions, ITRC surveyed existing state programs to determine what makes these programs effective and what issues affect the durability of ICs in their state. The survey was submitted to ITRC representatives for all 50 states, and 44 state responses were received. Overall, the survey responses have been used to identify which elements help maintain or create a more effective long-term IC program. As shown on the slide, this guidance focuses on ICs already in place rather than the details of selecting ICs. Properly selecting and implementing institutional controls, however, is essential for long-term durability and effectiveness. Therefore, this guidance provides a summary of some of the key components that are considered when choosing an IC, but it's not the focus. So during this presentation and in our guidance document, you will see this diagram which illustrates the five essential elements of the IC life cycle. Beneath the elements of the life cycle, we list the critical components that must be considered to achieve a successful IC management program. These essential elements and components essentially form the structure of the guidance document, and various sections in the guidance document address each of these elements. Together, these create an effective long-term stewardship program. As the presenters transition between each element, you will see this figure reappear on the screen highlighting the next topic. Now, we find that this guidance is relevant to environmental regulators at all levels of government, private and public responsible or obligated parties, current site owners and operators, environmental consultants, prospective purchasers of property, and real estate agents. Additionally, stakeholders who have an interest in a property will find this guidance helpful in understanding the elements required to manage institutional controls over the long term. This guidance assists those who are responsible for stewardship of ICs by describing the critical elements and best practices for an IC management program. Much of this document is based on the successes and lessons learned from established state and federal agency programs. Our guidance document provides further examples from specific state or federal program successes. As part of the guidance document, ITRC has also developed a downloadable tool that can help create a long-term stewardship plan tailored to specific sites. This tool incorporates the various IC management practices presented here today to assist in the early stages of the site-specific IC planning. Speaking of state examples, I'd like to provide to you an example from my state of a failure where inadequate communication and monitoring occurred. A prospective purchaser of property was conducting their due diligence prior to purchasing the property. The property was the location of a former leaking underground storage tank that was closed in 1997 with institutional controls in the form of a deed restriction that included a land use and a restriction and a groundwater use restriction. The property was to retain its commercial land use in accordance with the zoning. Now, during the due diligence efforts, the prospective purchaser found that the property had actually been split into two separate parcels, with one parcel now being zoned as residential, with a home built and a new drinking water well installed in 2001. These circumstances, unfortunately, went undetected by the regulatory agency until 2015, when a prospective purchaser called the regulatory agency and asked about the closure and the land use restrictions concerning the groundwater well. Subsequent investigatory work was conducted and fortunately determined that the new residence and drinking water well were side gradient of the contaminated groundwater plume and that the violations of the land use restrictions did not result in a long-term exposure to groundwater contamination. The breach of the institutional control had occurred only a mere 4 years after the placement of the restrictions on groundwater and land use. This should be well within the institutional knowledge that can reasonably be expected of an agency staff. However, with land use and permitting agencies operating as separate entities from the regulatory agency, the lack of an outreach program and a lack of a monitoring program led to confusion and ultimately the permitting of a drinking water well, a zoning change, split parcels with different addresses, and different parcel IDs from the original parcel that contain the restrictions. Now, presumably, an outreach program aimed at local health departments, which issue the water well permits in Michigan, the local health department would likely have known of the contaminated groundwater in the area and would likely have been better informed about the groundwater use restrictions. In recent years, the regulatory agency has implemented a local health department outreach program to discuss the use of an online environmental mapper database to ensure that they have all the information to fully evaluate drinking water well applications and to assist them in making good and protective permitting decisions. So this would be an example where we have reached out to not only a fellow agency that has a role in the restrictions, but also could be considered a stakeholder in the entire process. So why do institutional controls fail for other reasons or other states? Mary, could you please bring up the poll results from the start of the presentation and we can review some of the top vote getters? It looked like monitoring and communication were inadequate, which I've provided an example of in my state. But also interesting to note is that all of the options were checked. So there's been at least some sort of issue why the institutional control failed, which could be potentially a physical break of a barrier, inadequate reporting, violation of the actual restrictive covenant, which timeliness, myself, I'm actually involved in reviewing a property where a violation occurred regarding the restrictive covenant activities were undertaken in violation of that. And as we know, inadequate communication is another issue. So what makes institutional controls failures a significant issue is that the potential for exposure to contamination grows as more ICs are used and not properly managed and monitored. To illustrate the universe of ICs used across the nation, the map on the slide indicates that 60% of states that responded to our survey stated that they have over 200 institutional controls in place in their states. But what we have seen is that the programs to manage institutional controls vary widely, and some states do not have any formal institutional control management program. I can say in the state of Michigan, we have multiple different types of institutional controls, and one particular type being deed restrictions. Specific to our cleanup programs, we have over 3,200 institutional controls that we're aware of that have been recorded. So you can imagine trying to develop a long-term management program for just deed restrictions is quite a task to take, and we have started to formulate different processes and pilot projects to explore such a program. Now, there are solutions to prevent failures of institutional controls, which is presented in ITRC's new guidance document and discussed in today's presentation. An IC can only remain effective so long as it continues to be recognized, respected, and upheld by the affected stakeholders. Not only does the awareness of a new IC need to be communicated to the affected community, but as we have learned, this awareness should be maintained throughout the life of the IC. As we know, property ownership changes, enforcement agency turnover happens, and so on. Stakeholder outreach discussed later in the presentation includes identifying and involving internal and external stakeholders throughout the life cycle. As I said before, ITRC went one step farther and developed a downloadable tool that takes users through the process of planning and designing an IC management needs. This tool can create a long-lasting record of the site that includes regulatory authority, details of the IC, the responsibilities of all parties, a schedule for monitoring the performance of the IC, and more. The tool generates an editable long-term stewardship plan in Microsoft Word. If you are a consultant or a regulated entity who is closing sites with long-term monitoring that it is necessary, or even an agency regulator, you will really want to stay tuned to near the end of today's session where we will provide a brief tutorial on this downloadable tool. Up next is Doug Burge, representative from Ramble, who will be briefly discussing planning and implementation and then getting further into stakeholder outreach.
Thanks, Kevin. Real quick, I just want to let everyone know I'm actually working remotely at a job site, so I apologize if there's any background noise picked up, but hopefully I'm in a quiet enough area. So here is our life cycle diagram. You'll see this quite often through our presentation, life cycle of ICs. Now, our guidance, as Kevin mentioned, assumes planning and implementation has been completed and the sites move to the next stage, which is long-term management of those institutional controls. We as a group realize there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Guidance on planning and implementation already is available from USEPA, ITRC, and some states and others. And I've used that at sites, including a site of record closure I did in the state of Nebraska, that works very well. But where we found sometimes it falls short, and often falls short, is in long-term management. It's very good at describing how to put that into place, but after that, it's like have a nice life. So that's where our guidance document focused. However, I first want to provide a brief summary of planning and implementation, since they're both key elements to an IC. So the first element is planning. Be sure you understand your site. And that kind of goes without saying, you can't put an institutional control in a site if you don't know what you're controlling or why you're controlling it. But make sure you understand it and understand it thoroughly. Assess the parameters of concern, their distribution, what media is affected, what are the potential exposure pathways, land use, you know, is there residential development potential in the future? And also plan for the full cost of an IC. An IC is not a get out of jail free card. In some cases, you may want to soften your IC, maybe get to some spot remediation so your IC is less complicated, so it's going to be easier to implement in the long term. So remember, ICs have costs and responsibilities. So once you've completed the planning phase, the next phase is to implement your IC, which means formalizing it and then recording it. Now, an IC is just more than just a piece of paper sitting in a filing cabinet at a county recorder's office. That is just the beginning of your journey with an institutional control. So nearly half of the respondents to our ITRC survey indicated that lack of proper implementation was a reason for an IC failure. Long-term stewardship is a critical element in successfully implementing ICs. And as Kevin mentioned also, as part of our guidance document, we're providing a tool for developing a long-term stewardship plan. And my colleague Lynn Bailey will be discussing that later in this training. And I strongly suggest you consider use of, or at least reviewing, that tool. So moving on to communication and outreach. So outreach begins with planning and implementation of an IC, but it also extends through the entire life cycle of the IC, which could be decades, it could be forever. So for effective outreach and communication, you must identify your stakeholders, establish and also maintain communication with those stakeholders, and inform those stakeholders of their roles and responsibilities. You can think of these three items as ingredients. If each is properly addressed, then in combination, they'll result in successful outreach. But if you skimp or miss an ingredient, the result will likely mean you're going to have problems. Now, our ITRC survey determined that over 41% of IC failures were a direct result of inadequate communication. So just think about that. That means that almost half of the failures of an IC could have potentially been avoided if outreach and communication with stakeholders would have been effective. So remember, outreach success is equal to institutional control success, whereas outreach failure is equal to institutional control failure. So who or what is an IC stakeholder? Now, a stakeholder isn't just limited to the owner of a specific property that has an institutional control on it. It also includes all affected or interested parties. This can include individuals and groups such as nearby property owners, tenants, construction workers, future property owners, you know, I could go on. The list goes on and on. But what you need to do is use a broad brush when you define who is affected. And also in our guidance document, we provided a general summary of typical stakeholders and their potential concerns in Table 5 of that document. So where do stakeholders fit in? So each stakeholder in an institutional control has their own set of concerns as well as their own set of responsibilities to ensure continued success of that IC. You know, common concerns include health. I'm bleeding contamination at the site. Is this going to be a health issue? Is this going to affect the value of my property? How can I develop my property? There is a very common concern. Is this going to be a blight on my community? Responsibilities can be keeping records and reporting to a regulatory agency on some kind of a routine basis. There's a site in Minnesota that we close with an institutional control every year. We have to report to the MPCA to say that institutional control is still in place and still effective. So that means if an IC says don't install a well, that means you're responsible for not installing a well. And you're also responsible for ensuring that others don't install wells. So for an IC to be successful and remain effective, stakeholder concerns should be addressed, and they must be aware of and also understand their responsibilities. So remember, stakeholders are often a wide range of individuals and groups, and so are their concerns, so are their responsibilities, and so are their information needs. So there's many communication methods that can be used to provide information to stakeholders. Some of these methods are mandated when you put your institutional control in, and some are voluntary. But I suggest strongly that you put in as much communication methods as you can to keep it as strong, your institutional control as strong as you can over the long term. So there are two primary methods of communication that are often used in combination. That's direct and passive outreach. Direct outreach is also known as push. That means you're just pushing the information out to the stakeholders. This can include something as simple as posting a no fishing or a don't eat the fish sign. It also could be something much more sophisticated, like a when you call a utility notification dig request, it could put your institutional control on there. Not every state has that, but it's a very strong tool. My colleague Mike Sawinski will be talking about that a little bit later. Passive outreach, on the other hand, is also known as pull. That means you're making information available for the stakeholders to find and pull into themselves. That starts with putting the IC on a property deed. The property deed can be searched. They can go out, search it, and find it, and pull that in. Also, something such as providing information on an IC in a searchable database. I got a screenshot here from the state of Missouri. It's actually near my neighborhood in the city of St. Louis, and not far from my house, there is a dry cleaner that was closed with an institutional control. Now, I, as a property owner and resident, am a stakeholder, so I can search and see what's going on near my neighborhood. So also talking about push and pull communication, I have a site in Omaha, Nebraska that our client closed with an institutional control. And shortly after they closed that, the property was sold and subdivided into several different parcels. At that time, we let the new property owners, we pushed out information to those new property owners that, hey, here's institutional controls. There's some limitations and controls, one of them being limits to excavation. So fast forward 3 or 4 years, I got a phone call from one of those property owners, those new property owners, and they said, well, we're planning on doing some construction. There may be a little excavation. We know there's some controls on this. We just want to verify where we can do what we can do. And so I provided that information to them. But after I got off the phone, it was like, wow, there's a great example, push and pull. We gave the information to them to make them aware, the new responsible party there at the facility, and they then reached out and pulled in information for that. So providing multiple and redundant communication methods for IC stakeholders is going to help you to ensure success over the long term. Ignorance is not bliss when it comes to an institutional control. So stakeholder outreach status. In a nutshell, stakeholder outreach needs improvement. Based on the results of our ITRC survey, I see outreach as a work in progress, and as I said, it needs some improvement. As we've discussed, uninformed stakeholders are a recipe for IC failure. So our survey showed that the vast majority of outreach, nearly 90%, is focused on current property owners only. Of course, they're a very important stakeholder, but they're not the only stakeholder. Less than half of new property owners are included in outreach. So Kevin's example that he provided earlier, they weren't aware of the institution control and it failed. Only 20% of tenants or adjacent landowners are included in outreach. And as we discussed, there's a lot more stakeholders than just these I've listed, and those numbers, I guarantee you, drop down to single digits very quickly. So use robust institutional control outreach to inform and educate your stakeholders. This means identify and provide outreach to all potential stakeholders. Be aware of and anticipate stakeholder information needs. Tailor that information to stakeholders and keep it understandable. Don't use complicated jargon if you can avoid it. Try and use layman's language that's easy to understand. You know, oftentimes we slide into using acronyms and scientific terms, but if you can make it much more obvious and more direct, do that. Use both push and pull communication methods. And ICs and communication of ICs is not static. Revisit your outreach over time and update it as necessary. And again, the IC stewardship tool, which will be described later in this presentation, can help create and maintain that successful outreach to your stakeholders. So we've discussed the need for available, easily understood, and up-to-date records as part of stakeholder communication and outreach. And Doug Suter of GHD will next discuss IC data management and registries.
Thank you, Doug. So I'm going to talk a bit about registries. Registries are repositories for all the information that you would need to manage institutional controls over the long run. And I'm actually going to start out with a poll question. Mary, if you could bring that up. All right, so the question is, have any of you experienced or witnessed a problem or violation of an institutional control due to these things, where a registry could have made a difference? So it looks like the yeses are outweighing the noes, but there's a lot of uncertainty in addition to this. And I'm going to move on with what we found out with the survey that we did in 2015. So this one of the survey questions was, does your state agency employ an institutional control data management system, which is, you know, a registry? And, you know, this is from August 2015, so it's a little bit old, but the green shaded states have a registry in place and it has public access functions. The light blue have a registry in place, but it's really just for internal agency use. And then the dark blue do not have a registry in place, a formal registry in place. So from the survey, a couple of the causes of institutional control failures, these are specifically ones that a registry is really designed to help out with. The largest one, inadequate monitoring. A registry is going to have a lot of features that can allow you to monitor institutional controls. Next one, inadequate communication. This is the registry is really the hub for all communication efforts. And then the next one is location of institutional control not sufficiently described. And again, this the registry is where location information can be found easily. So first I'm going to talk about agency use of a registry. So the registry, you know, this is an electronic database with geographical components, and it will allow you to manage the institutional control, to describe the institutional control. You can manage outreach to stakeholders. This would include mailing lists, telephone directories, calendar items that can, you know, you can schedule different announcements. You can also schedule institutional control obligations. You know, do they have a five-year review? You can have a you know, little tickler for that, to, which comes up to remind you. You can also verify document compliance. You know, is the institutional control registered with the county? Things like that. You can track the reporting obligations. You can actually keep documents in the registry. And so, for instance, if you need semi-annual reports, you can track all of those inside the registry. And the last one, you have points of contact. You know, the registry provides the ability to provide contact information for the stakeholders. So here is an example. This is the same registry as was shown before. So this is Missouri. This is just a zoom in to some of the data that they actually have underlying that map that you saw earlier. And if you look at the tabs that are across near the top of this form, you know, you have a summary tab, which gives kind of the current status of what's going on. The list of contaminants, the contaminated media, soil, groundwater, vapor intrusion, different things like that. The next tab is objectives. So you can have cleanup objectives. Maybe you have site-specific cleanup objectives, and you can list those in there. The next one is choose instruments and instrument details. These are things like, is it a deed notice? Is it a compliance commitment agreement? Different legal forms that would make sure that the institutional control is properly recorded. The next tab is contacts. So you can put in all kinds of contact information. So this might be the agency project team. It might be stakeholders, property owners, people who have responsibility for different activities. And the last one, or second to last, is activities and monitoring. So if there is routine monitoring that needs to be done or specific activities, they could be listed there, and you can, you know, see what's been done and what hasn't been done. And the last one is simply a collection of reports that's accessible through the database. So now for the public use of a registry. Now, a lot of the stakeholders that we talked about before actually have some use of the registry, and the public use is typically more restricted than the internal agency use. For instance, enforcement documents would not be available for public use. But things like property owners, it talked about the property owner got the institutional control. It was actually recorded on his property, and he put that in with all of his papers for the purchase of the property and put them in a safe deposit box and has never looked at them since. Now, if he wants to suddenly recall what he needs to do with his engineer barrier or something, it's actually easier for him to just look on an online registry. Buyers, developers, and due diligence, all of those people really want to know if there's going to be a big problem, if it's going to affect the sale price, if they need to do specific investigation before they buy a property. The next one, construction and utility workers. It's very important for people to know if they are going to be breaching an engineered barrier and getting into contaminated soil. They probably need special training, maybe a health and safety plan, other things like that. And adjacent landowners, again, it would be very important for me to know if my next door neighbor had a big problem that could potentially migrate onto my property. And I would certainly like to know about that. So here's again from the Missouri page. So this is their geographic information system view of it. So you can actually locate things geographically, and you can zoom in and zoom out and see different areas and different details. So So this is the how you develop a registry. Now, most agencies are not going to start from scratch. They're going to have a series of project files. They're going to have a variety of internal databases, spreadsheets, personal knowledge, and all of these different things are going to be scattered throughout the agency files. So the first thing you need to do is you need to complete an inventory of the types of data you need and kind of the status of the data that you have. The next one to the right, key attributes. You have to figure out how you're going to the key features that you want to have. Some of these key attributes are going to be geographic attributes. You know, things like the address, the GPS coordinates, the property boundaries. Other key attributes would be, you know, does it have an US EPA number? Does it have a state EPA number? Any other attributes that are going to help you find a particular site when you're looking for it. And then over to the left, internal and external presentation. You know, we talked about the internal and external views of the registry. You're going to have to decide what kind of information would be viewable internally and what would be viewable externally. And that really goes along with the goals of the registry, and that can change from state to state. And then down at the bottom, frequent verification of accuracy. Now that you've put all this information that you've collected from these different departments and put it all into a registry, you're not done. That's only the beginning. And you're going to need to keep going with verification, and information is going to be wrong, and things will change, and properties will be subdivided, and someone will tell you one thing, and someone will tell you something else. And so you will have a lot of work to continue on, which brings me up to maintenance. So you're going to have a long-range budget to maintain the registry. And not only do you have to update and correct all the errors in the institutional controls, you're also going to have to, you know, whenever the web browsers are updated, you know, Google Chrome comes out new with a new version. Some people are still using Internet Explorer. Edge has a new version. All these things then need to be expanded on in your registry. And so that requires internal maintenance, make sure databases are up to date. It also requires typically your own either internal or external consultants who deal with the web design and getting all the information viewable to the public. And then I'm going to go back to the Missouri registry here. And this is just a zoom in on a particular facility. Now that you've got to this zoomed in scale, you can see that they've actually got the property boundary marked out and some information about the site itself. And then it has a little link that you can click. And that link would then take you to the additional information that's available. And so that's the basis of the registry. And it is, you know, it can be a very challenging project to undertake for an agency. And now it's time for the next phase, which is actually a question and answer phase. If Mary, if you'd like to take over.
Thank you, Doug. We do have time for questions and answers. For those of you on the phone line who would like to ask your question out loud, I'll give you an opportunity to do that in just a moment. Remember, it's #6 for the phone lines to unmute. For anyone at any time, you can type your question in that Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen, and we'll get to as many of those questions as we can. Just a reminder for those of you wanting documentation of continuing education, perhaps a certificate of participation, that is available by completing that online feedback form at the end of today's class. Once you fill out that form and click the box to certify you participated, that certificate will be provided to you. So let's go to our phone lines. If you'd like to ask a question out loud, use is your opportunity to do so. And remember, it's #6 to unmute. If there's any questions from the phone lines. All right, we will move on to a question I have here. It says, how do you decide who is responsible for the outreach regarding institutional controls?
This is Doug Burge. I guess I would look back at your, you know, we've got the list of, in our guidance document, the list of potential stakeholders and whatnot. You just got to kind of think through who's potentially affected by these. So I would just stop and think that through. And I think our, the long-term management tool too would probably help you think that through and make that identification.
But Doug, I think the question is more not only like who are you reaching out to, but how do you decide who actually takes the responsibility to do the outreach? Is it an agency? Is it the responsible party?
Ultimately, the responsible party was going to have the need to reach out. I think there may be some agency involvement on some of it. That's going to depend on the agency you're dealing with.
That's, yeah, and this varies from agency to agency, and it typically involves negotiation because a lot of times the agency wants to be involved in public outreach, like town meetings and that sort of thing. But the day-to-day implementation, they're usually going to want to put that right on the property owner.
Okay, and this next question is related to costs, and it says, how do you incorporate the cost of implementation of the institutional control? Do you add that into your project cost, or is it a standalone cost, or what's your experience with that?
This is Mike Sawinski, and I'm going to be addressing costs in my upcoming talk in a second, but I'll just say that states take two approaches. One is, in both cases, they're specific costs related to the project. And some states charge an upfront one-time cost associated with IC administration, and some states impose sort of pay-as-you-go approach where they charge a fee that they collect at some period based on the amount of effort they have to spend to administer the IC at a particular site.
And Lynn, did you have something to add to that?
Hi, Mary. I was actually typing as Michael answered, but he actually gave a more complete answer than I was going to give, so it's good that he answered first. I just might add that some states also have permitting requirements for RPs who are implementing ICs. Unfortunately, our state doesn't have that, and it all goes into our overhead, and we're responsible for any long-term management, the cost of that in all of our programs. But different programs also in different states might have different ways of managing the cost.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question. It says, do states that assign institutional controls have separate agency staff that oversee compliance with the long-term stewardship, or does that work effort typically fall on the same staff that oversees the management of the site while it is open or active?
Yeah, this is Doug Suter. My experience is mostly in Illinois with this. And the project managers remain with the site until the site gets transferred to a new project manager, and then the new project manager takes over. So it's just a whoever is project manager for that site continues to have the obligations.
Do any of the trainers have other experience in other states that would vary from that?
I have observed, I'm not a state person myself, but I've observed a number of states that take the approach that was just explained, yes. But there is a trend towards states starting a small staff, like a long-term stewardship, centralized staff that has as its primary focus to keep track and otherwise deal with institutional control, monitoring, and enforcement issues.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the questions and for the trainers providing those answers. We are going to move into the second portion of our training today. I'll move on over to slide number 39, and I will turn it over to Mike Sawinski with Teradex to talk about monitoring and performance evaluation.
Thank you, Mary. And unless I'm seeing it wrong, I don't believe I have the control. Oh, yes, I do. Excuse me. I was looking for that little arrow. Here it is. Thank you, and now I see it has control. I'm going to be speaking about monitoring and performance evaluation of institutional controls. So while there's a connection to what you've already heard, stakeholder outreach and creating and maintaining a registry, both of which are very important, of course, There are also other additional very specific steps that states are taking to monitor and in turn evaluate the performance of the institutional controls. And as you have already said in the earlier survey, institutional control of monitoring matters. It's, I think, was the highest ranked problem for institutional control violations cited earlier. So I'm going to talk about the common methods and best practices for IC monitoring and evaluating performance. And so what do I mean by that? Well, in general, you know, IC monitoring refers to the collection of data and information, and then performance evaluation refers to, you know, based on that IC, based on that data and information, what does that mean? What findings or conclusions? I realize that's a vague explanation, so let me tell you, speak about it in a little bit more detail. And also, as an aside, say that of the two, IC monitoring is where most of my remarks are going to be focused. So IC monitoring is not conventional environmental monitoring. So we're not talking about, you know, taking groundwater or soil samples. So recall that, you know, every IC, regardless of the form it takes or the legal construct it takes, tends to do similar things. It prohibits or conditions the use of different activities like groundwater use or excavation or residential use or schools or daycare or, you know, new structures. There's always some sort of set of conditions and limitations that can't happen at a particular property. And so IC monitoring refers to the collection of data information about the actual uses at the property at which an IC exists to learn whether those uses are in conflict or in sync with the institutional control requirements. And across the states, we found six different approaches. Inspections from the state, from the obligated party, excavation monitoring, land activity monitoring, local government coordination, and IC permit program. And I'm going to talk about all those, how do they work, what are the states doing, advantages, disadvantages. And as an aside, and this was not in place when we wrote our guidance document, but the EPA has since published, which I encourage you to look at, a guidance document titled The Use of Advanced Monitoring Technologies and Approaches to Support Long-Term Stewardship, and it details many of the same approaches that, particularly the ones related to technology that I'm going to be talking about here. But first, another pop monitoring poll. Which of the following do you utilize for monitoring of institutional controls? As the answers begin to come in and at the risk of impacting the results, I'll tell you that the inspections, and this is already bearing true, the inspection approaches, because they're conventional, they tend to be the most common ones to date. The other approaches, including excavation, land activity monitoring, and local government coordination, are increasing in use, but because they are more cutting edge, I'd say, tend to be less common to date, but still, but there is a trend, an increasing trend toward this. And as you can see from the answers you're putting in, that's exactly what your answers are showing, which is very much the same as what we found in the survey and very much the same what we found the times previously when we've had these trainings. So moving on from there, and I think you had, yeah. Let's just dive into each approach. So the first two, like I said, are conventional, so I can go quickly through them. But state agency inspection approach, where the state simply inspects the sites. They set a schedule that they manage internally. Sometimes some states have a form that's created for their staff. The agency staff visits the site. Date and findings are all recorded in the state internal database. All those copies are saved, and in some cases, states publish these inspections more very limitedly. Usually these are internal records just about what happened. Conceptually very straightforward. Some, you know, there's details in the execution, but there's, you know, it's a conventional approach. Similarly, and also conventional, is the approach where rather than the state performing the inspection, the states require the owner or the other obligated party, which is usually the owner, to perform the inspection. So here again, the requirements are ordinarily set within the institutional control itself, more specifically usually within the environmental covenant. So that recorded document will often say the owner or the original responsible party must submit some sort of annual inspection and certification to the state at some frequency, which is usually annually. Some states create standard forms for this, like the one shown here, and many states have to keep track of this and send out these reminder letters to the owners and keep track of the receipts of their excavations of the certification. So there's an administrative process here imposed on the state, even though the main focus is the main burden is on the landowner. And then when landowners or obligated parties don't send their inspection, that tends to elevate the site to a closer look by the state. And in the course of doing this, the states sometimes have problems finding, but eventually find out whether there's changes of ownership, because what will happen is they'll be sending out their letters, and the letters will get returned, and then they'll figure out that there's a new owner in the process, in this certification process, which is also useful information. The third approach is one you've heard mentioned before, that the use of excavation monitoring via the state one call services. So here, there's states connect to the 811 system, which provides the agency with notices of excavations. The agencies are able to send email or text advisories that warn the excavators that their excavation is near an institutional control or contaminated site. And to do this, usually third-party companies are relied on by the states to make the connection between the state and the 811 center work. So let me explain a little bit more about this, because it's not necessarily trivial. Conventionally, every state has a one-call center, and this all exists not because of environmental issues, but because of underground facilities. So every underground facility owner is obligated across the states to notify the one-call center about their gas and water and electric lines. And then the excavators are already obligated to call the 811 center to make sure that they find out about the lines before they dig, so they are not breaking into them. The 811 center then notifies the underground line owners, and the line owners are obligated to go out and mark the lines so the excavator can know what's happening. So leveraging that process, the environmental sites are able to register themselves or otherwise gain access to the 811 information, again, normally but not always facilitated by a third party, so that when the excavator is, when it becomes known that the excavator is planning an excavation at an environmental site, that rather than go out and mark, some big area of soil contamination, the states are able to send advisories, one or two page advisories warning the excavator and explain to the excavator how they are excavating in relationship to a state-regulated site or site of state interest, and alerting them what action might be necessary. I think I said earlier that this approach is less common, but increasing in its use. And even since the time when we published this guidance, I want to say three or four states that I know of have began taking this approach when they hadn't at the time when we wrote this guidance. I mentioned that there was an advisory that gets sent forward. This is an example of Delaware's advisory. I know you can't read the details, but the idea is that there's a map which shows the location of the excavation compared to the site and some explanation about what's going on and what actions might be needed or prudent. The fourth approach is land use activity and monitoring, which is like excavation monitoring, except in that there's additional set of information looked at other than just excavation. So here, there's a connection to an electronic feed of land activity information, permits, change of ownership, land development, schools, the daycare, water well permits, all sorts of, the internet and the public records are full with electronic and non-electronic data all about land activity. So connecting into that activity allows the agencies to get email alerts about activity that might be impacting the institutional control sites that they administer. And again, a third-party intermediary firms are ordinarily relied on for this approach to connect and filter all of these data sources so that the states can easily have access to them. That again is an approach that's more cutting edge, less common, but increasingly used. Fifth, and you heard this mentioned earlier by, I believe, Kevin in Michigan, where there's, you know, some states coordinate with the local governments to build connections that help the state, the local governments not make decisions that are adverse to the institutional controls. So based on our observations, we essentially saw three different approaches, which I, for the purposes of this presentation, I put on these informal terms on the side to mark them. But there's one that I call minimum coordination, which is when the state agency informs the local government about what they have, whether that's through an online website or a private set of information. It just helps confirm that the local government knows from the state where all the institutional controls are. And this approach relies on the assumption that with this information, the local governments will in turn do the right thing. And second is the approach that I call the eyes and ears approach, where this recognizing that the local government has a good sense of all the different applications that are being applied for, or a specific sense of the applications applied for land use, informs the state or acts as the eyes and ears and tells the state on some basis of all the activity that's being planned in the jurisdictions that might impact the state's institutional control areas. And then the third approach is where the local government might completely take over an institutional control scheme or regime, and that this tends to happen when at very big sites, Superfund sites, mining sites, where a whole city might be impacted by the contamination, like, you know, big swaths of soil contamination. And in those cases, you'll see local governments actually enact ordinances that they self-administer, and they're sometimes even called Superfund implementation ordinance and things like that. Those are, like I said, those tend to be, you know, when the whole local jurisdiction is impacted by Superfund, you'll see the local government really take a big lead. And then finally, I skipped. So this is a quick example of an eyes and ears approach in Colorado, where the state sends its GIS information to the local government, and the local government plugs it into their system so that they know where the different points of state interest are. And then based on that, as they get their permits, their permit applications every week, they're able to create a nice table and send it up to the state so that the state can, if necessary, take any action with the knowledge that they have about all these permits that are, you know, in application or finalized at the locations of interest. This Jasper County is one of a handful that I know about of local lead sites where, you know, there's an environmental contamination ordinance. Again, this is, you know, a big site, the whole county or a large part of the county was impacted, and the county really took a lead on administering the whole program. What we found, you know, when we asked in our survey about which one of these six approaches were being used, we saw a mix of states going from, well, not responding in a few cases, but to not having any program as of yet, to implementing one or as many as five of the six approaches that I just described. And I just realized that my slides are out of order, so I apologize, but there's actually the sixth approach is one that's in New Jersey, specifically for now, which is an IC permit. And I'd like to explain this as one being that's almost a glorified number two, or no, a glorified approach for the obligated party needing to perform certifications. When I mean glorified, I mean that it's formalized inside of an actual permit application. So rather than the obligated party having some annual certification requirements in their covenant, here there's an actual permit that they must get from the state with the fees that are associated with it that require it to submit to the state on a periodic basis information about the certification information about the soil or groundwater institutional control at issue. And then in some cases when there's engineering controls, there's some financial assurance requirements as part of this permit. We included this even though it was only one state was using it because it was novel and sophisticated enough to sort of rise to the level of being an alternative approach. Let me just back up. I'm not going to repeat myself, but just remind you that, like I said, one to as many as five approaches are being used in combination by many other states. And as just for example purposes, you know, the mix of approaches, and these are just four states, for the sake of demonstration, tend to include these certifications are a very common approach. State agency inspections on top of the landowner certifications is also common, and then some states are adding on by doing either the one call and the land activity monitoring and or the coordination with local government. So California, and I think this is still true now, it has the most robust or layered approach of different monitoring schemes in place. But states are, vary across the board. This is just a representative example. And as far as some of the assessment or the pros and cons, you probably gleaned this already from what I said, but the agency inspections and the owner certifications are good and powerful in that they're comprehensive, but on the con side, they're periodic. So whether they're 1 year or maybe even as long as every 5 years, they only are giving you a snapshot in time of what can be observed, and often a lot of things happen in between these periods. In the case of state agency inspections, obviously some agency staff are needed, and in the case of owner certifications, there's reliance on the landowner, but the agency staff still needs to administer and keep track of all the certifications. One call monitoring has a strength in that it's frequent, even daily, and it's comprehensive, but that it covers really only digging. So while digging is, while most land activities or most land development involves some digging, it tends to capture a lot of things, but not necessarily everything. And for states to implement this, it tends to need third-party services to be involved, although it's not a requirement. It just tends, as a practical matter, to be how things are happening, which is some I see as a con, depending. Land activity monitoring, daily frequency, a tailored coverage of land use activity, again, needs third-party services, which it could be a barrier in some cases. And coordination with local governments can be very powerful. I mean, leveraging the existing practices of local government, I think it's almost common sense to see how that could be a very, very powerful approach to making sure the wrong land uses don't happen at institutional control sites. And there's three different approaches, like I talked about, but these approaches are non-conventional in the sense that local governments don't tend to get involved in environmental cleanup. And because of that, there's an inertia that I witnessed across many states that tends to act as a barrier for local governments to be very actively involved in really monitoring or helping to monitor institutional controls. It's not a deal killer. It does happen, but as a practical matter, it's not like every state across the country and every local government is coordinating tightly to monitor institutional controls. It's more of an infrequent thing, at least so far. And then there's the IC permit, which has the same advantages as the inspections, and to a larger degree because it's formalized with an approach that includes an ongoing fee. We also recognize some best practices in the course of writing the report. And one is that, balancing the approaches and looking at the state portfolio is important because there's IC sites and there's IC sites. At some institutional control sites, the future restriction is very easy to comply with. The future restriction might be, no residential use, and other than that, and pretty much anything could happen at the property. So, and if it's a Home Depot with the parking lot and the future use is no residential, that's pretty easy to monitor. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there are sites with dozens of different restrictions, minutia restrictions about no excavation here, no water well there, no industrial use, or no commercial, no light commercial, or no mixed use unless certain precautions for vapor intrusion are taken, or whatever. And so the more the institutional control regime gets complicated, or the greater that the risk is that lies below, the more the IC monitoring regime tends to become important. So there's a triaging, and states that I've seen that have gone into more robust approaches tend to divide their portfolio so that a certain percentage will have a higher amount of land activity monitoring, and then another percentage might take a lesser approach. So going through that triaging we saw as the best practice that emerged. With that discussion of monitoring behind us, then once all that monitoring information based on whatever program is in place, and that empowers states to be smart about moving forward. And so the performance evaluation then in turn can conclude as to whether the ICs are protective, whether there's some IC compliance issues, whether they're minor and administrative or major, whether changes into the IC monitoring protocol are needed, or whether the IC can be terminated, or at the most extreme end, whether enforcement action is needed. And that's what the performance evaluation is all about, which is really only possible with monitoring information to base it on. As far as best practices, we found that looking at institutional control, monitoring, and stewardship as a thing at the state level, just like cleanup and redevelopment and voluntary cleanup programs and so forth have become a popular and important thing in state agencies, looking at policy or guidances to specifically address institutional control monitoring, or like I said earlier, to begin to devote a staff specific to institutional controls, we saw as based on responses and expertise from everyone involved as a best practice for states to start performing. I think some people will say, you know, cleanup is sliding towards stewardship, and state agencies ought to slide that same direction towards, so their programs begin to manage things accordingly. Finally, and I mentioned this earlier, is the issue of cost. So cost is always tricky, and there's kind of two prongs to cost. Is like, how much might an IC program cost a state? And then secondly, how do they pay for it? And as to how much the program might cost, you know, that's always going to remain a question, and it's, to some extent, always going to be state-specific, depending on how the institutional control prong might interweave into the rest of the state's environmental cleanup or redevelopment program. But at SWAMO, aside from the ITRC effort, has built a conceptual framework, which we think is helpful to at least identify all the cost elements that states might need to bear across the IC lifecycle, ranging from the very beginning through, you know, things like they call community engagement, what we were calling outreach, they call information management, what we were calling registry, to the monitoring and performance evaluation, and to the enforcement. So there, if you read their framework, you'll recognize that they make the point that, you know, it's easy to overlook all of these elements and to think that IC costs are, you know, only come to bear when someone drives out and to investigate an IC site, but really there's a lot more to it, and looking at all these elements and properly assessing the cost is an important thing. So when one can do that, then the next question is like, well, how do we get money into our state program to fund this? And states take two approaches to date, and not every state has an approach at all. But one example is the upfront fee example, which Missouri, for example, uses. And that, at the time of authorizing the use of an IC at a particular site, the state also collects a fee. In this case, by regulation, the state can capture a fee from $5,000 to $15,000. Whether a regulation is needed or not is a state-specific question. My personal sense is that the administrative authorities for most states would allow them to collect fees without going through a regulatory process, but that's a state-specific thing. In addition to the upfront fee approach, there are states that are taking what I call the pay-as-you-go approach, or an ongoing fee approach, and then this is a case of in California where each covenant, again, under the regulatory program that allows covenants in the first place, The covenants include language that the owner agrees to pay the department's cost in administering the covenant. And in a practical matter, what happens is that the state's sending a bill to these owners at covenant sites on a periodic basis that are specific to whatever fees that the state might have to bear during that time frame to administer the IC. Kind of like, you know, when states bill people for their oversight of voluntary cleanup. It's the same concept. So with that, let me turn it over to the next topic, which is enforcement of institutional controls.
All right, thanks, Mike. So we're moving from monitoring and performance evaluation to enforcement, kind of towards the end-ish of one of the important life cycle elements. If a violation or something comes up, I'm sure many of you on the phone or at your computer are geologists and engineers or other technical staff that focus on making sure all the appropriate exposure pathways are adequately defined and addressed by the chosen institutional control. Now, myself as a staff member who works as a liaison with our Attorney General's office, but and also with the technical project managers, I may be contacted when the enforceability or enforcement of an institutional control comes into question, which I alluded to at the beginning of the presentation. Somebody from our Superfund program, raised the issue, and now we are developing our approach to get the property owner back into compliance with the restrictive covenant. For this portion of the presentation, I'm going to highlight many of the enforcement tools contained in our ITRC guidance document that should be considered when planning, implementing, and approving the type of institutional control that is best suited for the selected remedy. Unfortunately, we have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. Now, even the regulated community will benefit from this part of the presentation, because having an understanding of the enforcement process for your state will provide understanding of the overall enforcement process, how it works for your state, transparency, and to be able to work through the enforcement issues too, potential defensibility or just general compliance assistance. Now, ITRC's survey illustrates weaknesses in state monitoring and compliance efforts. If adequate management and monitoring requirements are not established as part of a state IC program, then there's going to be little to enforce. Indeed, ITRC survey results indicated that approximately two-thirds of state agencies never have ever taken an enforcement action against a responsible party regarding institutional control. This is a significant statistic to keep in mind, because we know the failures and violations of ICs do happen. Overall, the data amplifies the necessary relationship between adequate IC management tools and the foundation that they provide to an overall meaningful IC enforcement program. So if we think of, in your own state, as the universe of ICs continues to grow with risk-based corrective actions, that's just more opportunity for something to happen and more of a need for an enforcement program to be in place to address those as quickly as we can. So a moment to stretch our fingers for a poll question. Does the state you represent or where you have implemented an IC have an enforcement process in hand if an IC violation is identified, regardless of whether an enforcement action has taken place? So the responses are simple, yes, no, or do not know. Okay, as the quick results come into play, the dominant responses are yes, there is a process, and also that most folks don't know if there's an enforcement process in place. So that's good to know as we move forward with the presentation to hopefully perhaps guide you to ask the right questions with your enforcement staff to see if there is an enforcement process in hand, that maybe there's something there to look for that hasn't been used yet, and we can move from there. So I've previously touched upon the concepts and challenges of considering enforceability during the planning and implementation phases of institutional controls, and Mike Sawinski just covered the importance of monitoring as part of a long-term management program. Now, in addition to these two challenges, which ITRC offers possible solutions in its guidance, identifying the proper parties to enforce the provisions of the institutional control can be complex and complicated, as some folks even have asked questions before related to stakeholders and who's going to have the authority over the institutional control. And even though IICs are most commonly tied to laws independently administered by state and local jurisdictions, many states may not have explicit authority written into their respective statutes. Add into that the uniqueness of native land and federal facilities. Another challenge is that there's no current model framework to guide a compliance and enforcement strategy that is specific to institutional control. And finally, the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act is a model statute that can be adopted into law and provide a legal framework to create, enforce, and terminate an institutional control. But the model language only provides for the conventional common law relief, such as trespass or nuisance, once a violation occurs, and does not provide that compliance assistance framework that many state regulators seek to use first, depending on the risk. ITRC's guidance document recognizes the challenges to enforcement of IICs and discusses various legal authorities beyond the traditional statutory dependence that regulators and other parties responsible for assuring compliance may use. For example, in my state, the law requires that restrictive covenants contain a provision granting the department the ability to enforce the restrictive covenant by legal action in a court of appropriate jurisdiction. So it survives property transactions. It's written right in there. We can cite to it, point to it whenever the need arises. Instruments such as consent decrees document an administrative or judicial court's approval of the settlement of an enforcement case filed in court. Typically, consent decrees specify actions to be taken or not to be taken by the settling parties. Consent decrees may have penalties attached too for noncompliance. So that's something to think about. If there is a court order in place for the site and a violation has occurred, you might use the court order as the enforcement vessel. Now, because there is no common model legal framework for institutional control, the ITRC guidance document suggests that the construction of a basic IC enforcement model can be premised on the traditional enforcement model that's used for water, air, and waste type of violations. When IC compliance failure occurs, enforcement can be strategically applied towards the party's return to compliance, also deter any future violations, and assure the protection of receptors from the threat of release or exposure. The ITRC guidance document suggests that voluntary compliance methods emphasize enforcement avoidance as well as intervention to educate a party on how to comply with IC requirements. In contrast, requiring involuntary compliance from a party through formal enforcement is generally considered the final administrative measure to resolve IC violations. Failure to respond to informal enforcement measures, violations with significant environmental impact, or parties with a history of noncompliance may generally be considered for that more formal enforcement approach. The ITRC's IC guidance document emphasizes that effective enforcement of an institutional control depends on the thoughtful IC planning. Enforcement actions may be considered when IC requirements have not been observed, have not been implemented or fail to meet the requirements, have not been adequately maintained or monitored, fail to have the required certification, or potentially fail to meet the reporting requirements that were previously established. Once a violation is identified through monitoring, inspection, reporting, or performance evaluation, the entity who can enforce can then choose either the informal or formal phase previously described. The ITRC guidance document describes the potential available tools for your agency when seeking to choose the informal voluntary compliance assistance approach. Voluntary compliance actions may take many forms and will vary from state to state, but some examples for you to be aware of include the informal correction letter, a request for corrective or compliance action, a deficiency letter, or an inspection report that identifies one or more issues concerning IC requirements. Materials that support the informal enforcement action can be provided to further support the action and to assist the obligated party in fully understanding the IC violation. These materials can include inspection reports, photographs, maps, and copies of relevant regulations or laws. Now, in the event that the party fails to respond to that voluntary compliance measure or fails in any requirement for corrective action within a specified schedule, violations with significant impact to the environment or obligated parties with a history of noncompliance may be generally considered for a notice of violation type approach without the benefit of voluntary compliance measures. Formal administrative measures may include administrative orders, civil judicial action, and in the most serious cases, criminal action. Now, I understand that the enforcement process may be a little challenging to put all together. So the ITRC guidance document includes real-world case studies. One such example takes place in Concord, Massachusetts. Between the early 1900s and the late 1980s, a building occupied the property by Light Manufacturing, so there was decades of operations. Between 1989 and 1990, the property assessment identified oil-stained soils with PCE and PCE-contaminated groundwater, so there was an issue. Remedial actions did not satisfy an unrestricted residential use, so a notice of activity and use limitation, which is also a synonym for a deed restriction, was recorded with the appropriate local register of deeds office in 1995. The Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection may audit any property for which an activity and use limitation was recorded. This is specified in the regulations. So in May of 2012, an audit was performed and the agency observed soil disturbance and stockpiled soil on the property. A few months later, the soil samples were collected and analyzed, detected concentrations of PCE and extractable petroleum hydrocarbons. So these stockpiled soils were moved on the property. The earth moving activities by the tenant at the site were observed without a required health and safety plan or soil management plan. These are both violations of the activity and use limitation. Now, Massachusetts law provides for administrative penalties up to $25,000 per day for failure to comply with the terms of an activity and use limitation. Pretty significant amount. In this case, Massachusetts assessed a penalty of approximately $5,692 and negotiated an agreement with the property owner to record an amended activity and use limitation to address the violations described above and pay $4,000 in penalties while the rest were held in abeyance. Massachusetts authorizes an administrative enforcement framework that begins with the issuance of compliance assistance letters to property owners who have a notice of activity and use limitation on the property deed. Failures identified through the audit program to comply with the activity and use limitation is a failure to comply with the Massachusetts contingency plan, and an enforcement action may be initiated, as happened in this case. So in summary, planning for an IC enforcement action should take place at the time that the site-specific IC requirements are developed to carefully evaluate enforceability, interested parties, jurisdictional requirements, and methods of enforcement. It actually should occur as early as development of what we like to promote, the long-term stewardship plan, which Lynn Bailey from the State of Hawaii will now introduce.
Thank you, Kevin. I just would like to go over a few definitions before I move forward. As Kevin mentioned in slide 9, our team document in this training assumes that the IC is already in place before we start their long-term stewardship process. An institutional control, as our team glossary defines it, is a legal or administrative restriction on the use of or access to a site or facility to eliminate or minimize potential exposure to chemicals of concern. Now, long-term stewardship is what is required to ensure that the IC remains protective of human health and the environment throughout the full institutional control life cycle. And that's the focus of this whole training. Now, a long-term stewardship plan is kind of the instruction book of long-term stewardship requirements, and it'll be the focus of this next section. So many of our discussions have focused on the discovery of ICs in relation to property transfers. However, as Michael discussed during the monitoring part of the presentation, a lot can happen between those property transfers. In fact, institutional controls are often breached during other circumstances like construction or emergency utility repairs, as shown in this picture. These photos at a location in Hawaii that needed emergency utility repairs. It's an area with known contamination, and contamination that's obvious when it's encountered, as you can see in the photos on the upper left there. Also on the upper left photo, you can see the intake hoses for some pumps that are extending down into that pit. Unfortunately, there were no frac tanks or pump trucks at the output end of those hoses. Instead, the hoses drained onto the grassy median, then flowed into the street and into the storm drains. Now in Hawaii, the storm drains lead to the ocean. So our state on-scene coordinators became aware of the release when someone called to report a large sheen in the nearby harbor. At the time of the release, there was no environmental hazard management plan, which is Hawaii's version of a long-term stewardship plan. The EHMP shows where the contamination is, what it is, and how to manage it. Had there been a long-term stewardship plan and had all the stakeholders had access to it, we could have prevented that larger issue, the release to the ocean, impact to the environment, fines from state and federal governments, and the negative public attention. On the bright side, a year ago in July, there was another emergency utility repair in the same area, and I biked by on my way to work and saw a big frac tank, a big tanker truck there that was collecting all the wastewater from the site, and I later followed up with the utility and heard that it had been done correctly. So it does pay to have all the stakeholders aware of what's going on at your site, and to have a long-term stewardship plan so everybody knows what to do. Now, in spite of the importance of maintaining long-term stewardship of institutional controls, the ITRC survey found that only 52% of responding states in 2015 required some sort of long-term stewardship plan. So our team developed a template to create a solid plan and a tool that will help you create a long-term stewardship plan of your own. The long-term stewardship plan is written after the institutional control is in place, and it functions much like an operations and maintenance plan or an EPA implementation and assurance plan. A good long-term stewardship plan will put together the requirements of that institutional control, including any engineering control management. It's also a comprehensive guide for monitoring all the aspects of the institutional control. And it's a good thing to think about at the beginning of that long-term stewardship process. A good long-term stewardship plan delegates who is responsible for the different steps in the monitoring, reporting, and enforcing of the IC. Our poll at the beginning of this presentation found that about 54% of you experienced IC failure due to inadequate communication. more than 70% attributed IC failure to inadequate monitoring. Stakeholders must understand their responsibilities for these ICs to be effective. Of course, the ultimate goal is to keep the requirements of the institutional control in place long term to protect human health and the environment, even when the people who initially implemented the IC are no longer part of the project. The writers and keepers of the long-term stewardship plan will vary state by state. But in general, the obligated party or the responsible party would write it. In some instances, a regulatory agency may choose to write the plan themselves. For instance, in Hawaii, we have written EHMPs to manage old sites with historical contamination that are within public rights of way where the obligated party or the responsible party is no longer identifiable, but the contamination remains. This slide shows a small subset of people who should keep the long-term stewardship plan. These are kind of the obvious stakeholders. But there was a more complete list that was shown on slide 21, which included tenants and adjacent property owners. The long-term stewardship plan should also be easily available to anybody in the public upon request. Generally, the more people who are aware of the locations of the institutional controls and the requirements of the institutional controls, the more likely we are to maintain the integrity of the ICs and protect human health into an environment long into the future. So, although the task of writing a long-term stewardship plan may seem daunting, it's not as complicated as it may seem. All of the historical information needed to set the stage for a successful long-term stewardship plan can be found in the site closure documents that you already have, like RODs or NFA letters or proposed plans, and the IC document itself. The same documents that Michael discussed being important for performance evaluation are the documents that we need to create the long-term stewardship plan. Some are listed here. But different states and different programs have different types of documents that can be good resources. Additionally, some ICs are interim ICs. These are for sites where remediation is pending or in progress. In that case, you would pull information from finalized characterization reports like remedial investigation reports or feasibility studies, as well as from the interim IC. The long-term stewardship plan will build on the information in these documents to tie it to the components such as monitoring, registry, outreach, and enforcement that the team discussed earlier in the presentation. So, in order to show how simple it can be to create an effective long-term stewardship plan, our team created a sample site called Easement. This site was brought to our attention when the tenants of the casting yard northwest of the site were excavating across a pipeline easement to put in wiring for some lighting. As you can see in the figure, it's a fairly open area surrounded by industrial land. It's a small rectangular site with institutional controls for observed-free product, groundwater contamination, and soil contamination. For our easement long-term stewardship plan, we got that information from the historical documents that we just discussed. Not only do we pull text, but we also got some figures from the historical documents and pulled those directly into our plans. Some of the figures that we included are a site plan with labeled areas of concern and institutional control boundaries, contaminant figures showing delineated chemical of concern boundaries and the affected media. We also pulled other information from the tables and the text and the documents, including site background info, information that you typically see in these types of reports, such as past, current, and anticipated future site use, summary of previous investigations, including all the impacted material, all the impacted media, all sources of chemical releases, chemicals of concern, applicable screening levels, and the exceedances. So here's an example of a figure that we pulled into our long-term stewardship plan from our historical documents. The utility excavation where contamination was initially identified is shown in red. The five horizontal dotted lines are pipelines, which would be the assumed source. The green rectangle surrounding the site is the area that's bounded by the institutional controls. The coordinates of the IC boundaries are shown in call-out boxes at the corners of the control area. The property boundary of the easement is near the middle of the site and is shown by a dashed black line. And a road cuts through the southwest. The boundary of soil contamination above the screening levels is shown in orange. This is a simplified map for our presentation. Your long-term stewardship plan contaminant figure most likely will have additional details like call-out boxes with contaminant concentrations, depth to the contamination, etc. For our site easement, the long-term stewardship plan will contain additional maps clearly delineating the groundwater and the free product contamination at the site. Since easement has one area of concern that has one type of institutional control, this simple type of map is sufficient. However, if you have a site that has multiple IC boundaries, ensure that your long-term stewardship plan figures clearly show those boundaries and the contaminants within each. Now, although the technical aspects of contamination management at this site seem very simple, the management responsibility is not clear. There is a pipeline easement with two separate companies responsible for the pipeline. The casting yard is run by another company that leases this portion of land from a large landowner in the area. The contamination was discovered when the casting yard crew excavated an easement to put in some lights. And if that scenario isn't complicated enough, at the time of discovery, the large landowner was finalizing a sale of the land to a new landowner. It is important for the long-term stewardship plan to identify all of these stakeholders and clarify which is responsible for each step of the monitoring and reporting into the future. Doug Burge discussed how effective communication and outreach between stakeholders can increase IC success. As we write the long-term stewardship plan, the roles and responsibilities of each stakeholder must be clearly defined throughout the remaining cycle of the IC, all the way through the monitoring and performance evaluation, the enforcement, all the way to the modification and termination if things get cleaned up. Additional known and potential stakeholders from Table 5 of the ITRC document can be included in an appendix of your long-term stewardship plan. Now, when there are so many parties involved with a property with institutional controls, how can we ensure that the integrity of the institutional controls will continue to protect human health and the environment well into the future? There's an app for that. The long-term stewardship tool allows users to generate a long-term stewardship plan, which can be further edited to smooth the language, add or delete information, or improve functionality. After generating the document, ensure to coordinate with local regulators to ensure that the long-term stewardship plan that you create for your site meets all the regulatory requirements for whatever program you're working under. So to get started, click a link in the team document on the ITRC webpage to download the tool, and we'll give you that link at the end of the presentation. Within a zip file, you'll see a folder called IC_tool and a PDF document called README First. Open the README First file, and you'll see step-by-step instructions for saving and opening the tool. I know that seems very simple, but these instructions will save you from errors and frustration later, so please don't disregard them. One error that we encountered as we were building the tool resulted when people ran the tool from within a zip file without extracting it. So in order to avoid that error, the README file instructs you to drag the IC_tool file to your desktop before you open it. That will extract it automatically for you. Now that you've extracted the IC_tool folder, you'll see the folder called IC_tool on your desktop. Now, I want to make a quick note here. The name of the file is somewhat misleading. We should reiterate that the tool will be used to create a long-term stewardship plan, not an IC. Please remember that this ITRC guidance assumes that the IC is already in place. This tool will help you define the process to manage the requirements of the IC to ensure that the IC remains protective throughout the full life cycle. So once you open the IC_tool folder, you'll see a folder called Images, a folder called Template, and an Excel file called IC_tool. Now this is important. Please keep all of these files and folders together as they are packaged until you complete the entire process of creating your document. Changing the folder or file name or moving files or folders will hinder the tool functionality at this stage. So click the IC_tool Excel file and open it. For many users, the tool table of contents will pop up immediately after you open the Excel file. If so, your screen will look like what will show you on the next slide. For other users, especially those who have strict security protections like I do on my computer, you may need to enable editing, enable content, and/or configure Excel to trust VBA. Now, the README First file will show you how to do this. And don't worry, you don't have to do that every time you open the tool. Probably just the first time you open the tool on a new computer would be when you would need to do that. So once these steps are complete, your screen will look like the one shown here on this slide. Also, one cool feature of this tool is that you don't have to do everything in one day. If it takes you a while to work on this tool and you have to come back to it later, you can close it out. So if you close the tool and reopen it to work on it later, you'll see this screen. Clicking Click Here to Get Started will send you to the form page where you left off. Clicking Reset Answers will clear all the previous entries and return you to the beginning. So now the first time that you use the tool, whether you've just clicked that Click Here to Get Started or whether the tool auto-opens, the first thing that you will see is the tool table of contents. Click Next to go to the next slide. On each page of the form of the tool, you'll see a blank form. And notice that there are four buttons at the bottom. During any time in the process of answering questions and creating your long-term stewardship plan, you can return to the previous page of questions or look at the table of contents. The next button is used to advance the tool to the next set of questions in the form. Now, please note that any form question that's marked with a red asterisk is required. You will not be able to click Next until all the questions marked with a red asterisk are completed. As you answer the question, fill in the information appropriate to your site and write as if you're really writing a document, not just giving short answers to a questionnaire. Use the information in the decisions that are written in the IC documents and the site closure documents. If there's an interim IC and remediation is ongoing or pending, use the information in the interim IC and the existing finalized characterization reports. In some cases, the answers you provide in one question will fill into more than one location in the long-term stewardship plan that you are creating. So, that's why we warn you not to use sentence fragments or abbreviations unless you want the information to be shortened throughout the plan. Note the red circle that I've got here around the word department. You'll also be able to upload figures that will be inserted into the document. Again, feel free to choose these figures from existing site documentation or create your own image files to upload. Whenever you'd like to check your work, you can click on the preview button on the lower right-hand corner of each page of the form. The preview button will allow you to see how your information has been filled into the form and make corrections within the tool if you wish. The answers you gave to questions within the tool will be highlighted blue. Well, on mine it shows blue. It might be a different color on yours, but you can see how the information is highlighted on this, wherever it auto-filled into the long-term stewardship plan I created. You'll notice that the highlighted text imported into the plan exactly as I wrote it in the form, including the abbreviation. Based on reviewer comments, if you did leave some answers blank in the form tool and you click on preview, you will see a highlighted question not answered where the blank in the where the information was not imported into the form. Now, our easement site is technically fairly simple with just one area with institutional controls. However, if you have a proper review with different ICs in different areas, you can still use this long-term stewardship tool to create a plan that'll work for your multiple areas. Just click yes for second, third, or fourth areas. You will then be led through a series of questions about which types of contamination are controlled with institutional controls and engineering controls within each of these areas. Michael talked about the importance of monitoring and performance evaluation. The long-term stewardship tool asks questions in the monitoring section that tie back to the institutional controls and engineering controls requirements specified earlier in the questions in the tool. This section of the tool helps you to choose what types of monitoring are required, who is responsible for the monitoring, how to report the results, and who to report to. After completing this section of the tool, a table like this will be included in the long-term stewardship plan for your site. Now, that previous slide showed what your table looks like in the document in, as you preview it. But this slide shows how these tables are generated within that form tool. The column headings are shown, and one blank row is provided. Start by clicking on a cell and select a response from a pull-down tab or type in a response. And go cell by cell to complete the row, and once you complete the row, click on the plus sign to add a new row. Continue filling in information and adding rows until your table is complete. After all the required questions have been answered, tables have been generated, and figures have been uploaded to the tool, click on the Create Report button in the bottom right-hand corner of the last page of that form tool, and a document called ITRC IC Final will be created in the folder within the template. Feel free to, now, at this point, you can save this as another name in another folder, and do with it what you wish. You can edit it like you would any other Word document. You can edit the text, you can format the headings, you can add or delete image files, you can spell check, whatever you would do with a typical Word document to polish up your report. Note that in the final document, all those highlights that you saw in the preview will be gone, and anything that you did not answer will just show up as a blank. It will not say question not answered anymore. You can save the form, answers, and the whole IC tool package and use it again as it was, or you can reset the form to use it for a new long-term stewardship plan for another site. If you'd like to reset the form, you click on that TOC button to take you back to the table of contents, then close the form and click Reset Answer button. Now, as promised, here's a link so that you can download your own tool and generate your own long-term stewardship plan. I'd like to hand it over to Carol Murphy from Tri-Hydro Corporation so she can summarize all the information we discussed today.
Thank you, Lynn. To wrap things up, I'd like to circle back around to the diagram that you see on your screen. And throughout this presentation, we've presented the diagram, and it's also presented in the guidance document. And as we've discussed, the blue arrows across the top represent the critical elements of the institutional control life cycle that we identified throughout developing the guidance document. And then beneath the blue arrows, we list what we consider to be the critical elements that should be considered to achieve a successful institutional control management program. And we believe that failure of any of the elements can result in ultimate failure of the institutional control. And these elements then basically form the structure of the guidance document. And as we've discussed, the guidance document also provides examples and recommendations for good stewardship practices, including the tool that Lynn just presented for developing a long-term stewardship plan. Now, as a consultant, I was especially excited about the tool that we developed before we started this process. My company was asked to develop a long-term stewardship plan for a project site where an institutional control was being put into place. And at that time, we didn't really have a lot of guidance on how to do that. So that's been very helpful to us. So as we wrap up, we'd like to ask you to think about the institutional controls where you are a stakeholder, and we'd like you to ask yourselves, how are the institutional controls being managed at your site ensure long-term success? How are you managing those sites? And when we asked the states at the beginning of this process during our survey how they were managing the process, we asked the states if they had, you know, processes in place to manage institutional controls across their various state programs. And at the time, you know, this is about 4 years old now, but at the time, about 64% of the states responded that they did not have standard procedures or practices for selecting, using, and implementing institutional controls across their various programs. So you can see on the map, the blue states said that they did have processes, but the gray states did not at the time. And once again, that's probably changed. But so if you don't have formal institutional control management programs in your state at this point, don't worry, you're still probably not alone. But that being said, if you don't have programs in place to manage your institutional controls, we'd like you to consider how confident you are in the long-term integrity of the institutional controls at your sites. And how do you know that they're continuing to be protective, and how do you know that they continue to prevent exposure to the contaminants that were left in place? So to leave you with one more example, just a real-world example in my experience, how this can be a real-world challenge, I was doing some work for one of my clients, which happened to be an insurance company. And they had a potential client that wanted to put an insurance policy on a property that had an institutional control in place limiting the site use to commercial and industrial use. And they were a buyer, and they wanted to redevelop it, the property, for residential use. But at the time, they didn't realize the site had an institutional control in place limiting the site use to commercial and industrial. And so after I did the review, I pointed that out because I was able to identify the institutional control just through just a public document review and the documents that were provided to us. And needless to say, the insurance company would not place the insurance on the redevelopment unless the institutional control was modified, which probably would have required additional remediation. So there are real world, as we've said, you know, given several examples throughout this presentation, there have been many cases over the years where this has been a real issue. So we hope that throughout the presentation, we've drilled home the point that you can use the guidance document to help you develop a long-term stewardship plan, but we also realize and recognize that you're gonna have to go back to your organizations and convince the key decision makers in your organizations to spend the time and the money to put these programs into place. And so we'd like to encourage you to hold up this guidance document to support your cause when you're discussing these issues with those key decision makers in your organizations. And we think that you can use the guidance document as a credible consensus-based tool to support your discussions with those key decision makers. And remember, the ultimate goal of institutional controls is just to prevent exposure to contamination that's been left in place. It's really that simple. If there's a failure of an institutional control, then the risk of exposure to the contamination goes up, which we would all, of course, like to prevent. And ultimately, we hope that this guidance document will help you avoid the situations like the ones that we discussed. Kevin gave the example of the situation in Michigan, and Lynn gave the example of the situation in Hawaii that we presented, where there were failures of institutional controls in their states. And we believe that these situations could have been avoided if the states had used the recommendations and suggestions presented in the guidance document. And in fact, in discussions, further discussions with Lynn after the fact, in Hawaii at the same situation, there was another emergency utility repair in the same area as the one described, that she described earlier. But this time, the utility company used frac tanks to collect the groundwater instead of discharging the groundwater to the storm drain. So they did it right that time, and they learned their lesson. So to conclude our presentation, we'd like to encourage you to review the guidance document and try out the long-term stewardship plan. We know we've covered a lot of information today, so if you'd like to go back and review the presentation, an archive of the training session will be available through ITRC. And also, please feel free to contact any of the trainers if you have further questions. Our contact information was provided on the slide at the beginning of the PowerPoint presentation, which is available on the ITRC website. With that, we'd like to thank you for participating in our training today, and I'll turn it back over to our moderator. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. We do have time now for questions and answers again. Remember, you can type your question in that Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. Before we get to some questions, just a few items of wrap-up. I'm going to pull up a couple more poll questions for you to fill out as we conclude today, so if you'll take a moment to do that, we'll appreciate that. Also, that initial page you were directed to, that clue and training page, accessible over in the related links section, that has that presentation overview as well as where you can download a copy of today's presentation and see pictures and bios of our trainers and their contact information. That page will remain active. If you'd like to come back to it at a later time, you're welcome to do so. Also, we would like to hear everyone's feedback today on how the training went for you today, so be sure to fill out the online feedback form. It's linked on this last slide. Also, you can access that over in that related links section by clicking on feedback and then browse too. Especially those of you wanting a certificate of participation, be sure to fill out that online feedback form. Click that box at the end to certify you participated, and then that certificate will be provided to you. We'll move on to a few questions. In thinking about institutional control monitoring, what is the recommended best practice for frequency of monitoring, and who and how is that decided?
Well, I guess I'll take that for starters since I spoke to that section. As far as the frequency of monitoring and how it's decided, there, to the best of my knowledge, there's no set rule. There are some guideposts even out there by the EPA who has stated in their institutional control and implementation plan guidance that monitoring should be at least annually, but in some cases when there are risks, et cetera, and I'm paraphrasing obviously, that more frequent monitoring is appropriate. Other than that, what states tend to do is, like we found during the guidance, triage and make a judgment call as to whether the set of restrictions and the underlying risks are appropriately handled by an annual type of restriction or need more. And some of the factors, and this is my opinion now, that some of the factors have to do with whether the residual, whether the density of use and activity in around the area, like an urban setting, is likely to trigger activities, whether they be excavation or utility line repairs, like Lynn showed, or whether that the on the other hand, if the risk is small and the area is in a very rural environment where less is likely to happen, then the monitoring frequency would tend to be longer. So those are some of my personal opinions and some facts that I happen to know.
Would any of the other trainers like to share their experience related to frequency of monitoring?
Well, I would just point out, like I brought this, Doug Burge, I brought up my site in Minnesota, that once a year they have to send a letter to the state stating that those institutional controls are still effective and in place and haven't been violated. But, you know, if you go out, if someone is inspecting a property once a year, you've got 364 days of the year where other things could have happened. So I guess it's to your benefit or to the benefit of the long-term management of that control to do some kind of ongoing, more frequent interim reviews before things, you know, other than just an annual review, because a lot can happen in a year.
Okay, this next question is specific to the institutional control tool, and they're wanting to know, can they use the tool to create a plan for multiple properties within one file?
Hi, this is Lynn. I would think you could. So where it talks about what it gives you the chance to write to on the tab on the form where you can enter up to four different areas, I would think you could do that for your site if it's under a plan. And then it'll lead you to your specific questions for each of the sites. Just name each of those areas as if it were your site. And then if you have more than four, then you can just copy-paste that information into the template or into the Word document after it's completed and just title it in a way that makes it very clear what the document covers.
Right. Well, thank you so much for the questions and the trainers for answering the questions for us today. If we have not addressed your question in full, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org. And we'll do our best to follow up the trainers to answer questions, or you're welcome to email the trainers directly. A special thanks to our participants today. We very much appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to be with us. Remember, we do have archives available of most of our training classes, so if you aren't able to attend a live offering, you're welcome to access our archives. A special thanks to our trainers who have not only participated in the training today, but many classes in the past, as well as all their time in developing the associated guidance document and the online tool. We really appreciate you serving as ITRC volunteers and trainers. Be sure to fill out the online feedback form by clicking on that link in the middle of this last slide. Also, you can access it over there in the related links section. I believe that wraps us up today. Thanks so much for